Hi there, I'm Jason Shulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today is Carwin Jones. He's a senior lecturer in the School of Law at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. He's here to talk about his new book, New Treaty, New Tradition, Reconciling New Zealand and Maori Law, published in 2016 by the University of British Columbia Press. Carwin, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Well, it's great to have you here. So, Carwin, first off, how did you get interested in Maori law and Maori legal history? You have kind of a personal connection to these issues, is that right?
I do, yeah. So I am Maori myself. I'm from a Maori nation called Ngāti Kahununu. And so partly my interest came from the fact that, these questions around Maori law, around the reconciliation process, around historical treaties and Maori rights were sort of part of the conversations that I heard in my family. And it was something that, as I was going through law school, was something that was getting more and more attention. And then there were some important developments through the late 1980s, early 1990s. There was some exciting stuff going on during that time.
So what is Maori legal history? You say it's not, as most people believe, you know, the laws that have, or the development of laws that apply to the Maori people. It's more than that.
Yes, I think one of the important things to understand about when we're talking about Maori law is that Maori, like any other society really, have an existing legal system. So we're not just talking about law which, when in New Zealand's case, after sort of contact with Europeans, with the British, there was imposed a system of the common law, which came from England. So we're not just talking about those aspects of that legal system which apply to Maori or affect Maori, but we're actually talking about that system of law that Maori were already using, the kind of system that they had for regulating their own society and communities, their social interactions, their economic activity, all of those kinds of things.
And even if, you know, listeners aren't familiar with the specifics of Maori law, I think that, you know, they will be familiar with the idea that, you know, Maori law is influenced by and influences kind of the state law. And that's kind of common in a lot of jurisdictions, right?
Yes. And so we have a number of ways in which that happens. In New Zealand, we see some specific recognition through our legislation or through our statutes. We see the common law has the ability to recognise aspects of Maori custom as law, and that's the same throughout the kind of common law jurisdiction. So we see the same thing in Canada and the United States and in Australia as well, that ability to recognise in particular aspects of Indigenous property rights usually. So there are a number of ways in which that happens. And one of the things that we're seeing now in New Zealand is, as we're moving through a kind of process of reconciliation and dealing with some of these historical issues, that there's becoming an increasing recognition of Maori law and how that might apply in terms of co-management or co-governance, particularly in the natural resources or environmental law space.
What are some of the key elements of Maori law that listeners should know? I mean, one of the key things that I think recurs in the book is that there's all these tensions within Maori law, very productive tensions, but tensions nonetheless.
So one of the things that I think is useful to understand about Maori law is that it's very much driven by a sort of set of key values, and it has quite a lot of flexibility. And these values sort of interact, and some might be given more emphasis at some point than others. But essentially, you can look to these key values and say, this is what's trying to be achieved when you set up these particular practices or these particular norms or rules or laws that need to be followed. And so some of them, the kind of really fundamental one is this idea of what the Maori term for it is whanaungatanga. And this idea is really about the centrality of relationships in the Maori world, so that really all relationships in the Māori world are sort of understood through a kind of kinship lens. And so that includes not only your actual kin relations amongst your family and your extended relations, but also includes relationships with, for example, the natural environment. So those are understood as actual kin relations. And that then has an impact on how you engage with the natural world and how you set up systems and policies and laws which regulate that interaction with the natural world as well. So that's a kind of central one, but there are others as well. There's very much in the Māori world and in Māori law an important sense of striving towards balance, and so we see the concept of reciprocity being very key in the development of Māori law. And probably one other one to pick out as a concept, which we talk about as mana. And mana is this idea of it's a kind of authority, and importantly it's spiritually sanctioned authority, but it is dependent on both your some of it is inherited, but it's also dependent on your own actions. And that concept really provides an important, it empowers Māori leaders, but it also provides important limits and constraints on the authority of leaders in the Māori world.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit of history. Maybe you can kind of help those of us who don't know that much about it. You know, tell us, what is the Treaty of Waitangi and why is it so important?
Yeah, okay. So the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, and it's called the Treaty of Waitangi because it was signed at a place called Waitangi, which is in the north of the North Island of New Zealand. And it was signed between initially a grouping of Māori chiefs in the north, and then later copies were taken around the country, and it was signed by over 500 Māori chiefs over the next few months. And the other party to the Treaty of Waitangi was the British government, or the British Crown, signed by a naval officer, William Hobson, who was sent out here on behalf of Queen Victoria to negotiate this treaty with Māori. Now, what's important about the treaty is that this is what really sets up the basis for the colonial government to be established in New Zealand. And in doing so, it also provides some important guarantees and protections for Māori. So at the same, what it does is it says Māori chiefs will allow this British government to be established, and there's some debate as to what was understood by that, whether that was understood to be government over the entire population of New Zealand or whether this was understood to be just government over the British settlers and the British citizens who were in New Zealand at that time. But at the same time, it provides this these protections for Māori, and these quite strong guarantees, actually. And so partly those are phrased as property rights. So Māori are guaranteed to enjoy the undisturbed possession of their lands and forests and fisheries. But in the Māori, there's a Māori language text of the treaty, and in that text, the kind of key concept that is being guaranteed to Māori is this idea of tino rangatiratanga. Now, tino rangatiratanga comes from the base word is rangatira, which is the Māori word for chief, and tino at the start of that is an intensifier, so it's really talking about guaranteeing all those special qualities of chieftainship or absolute chieftainship, or we might talk about it today as being self-determination. So right from 1840, we have this setup in which public power, if you like, is going to be shared between the settler government and the Māori chiefs. But as is often the way with these kind of foundational documents, constitutional documents, you don't necessarily have a lot of detail about the specifics of how that's going to work. So you get some key principles, but the kind of the precise terms on which that public power is going to be shared actually gets played out over the next, over the next sort of 177 years now, looking at well, what does that relationship mean? And what we've seen the courts in New Zealand say is that what it set up was a partnership. And so the key idea really is to think about how to give effect to that partnership between Māori and government.
Now, as we get into more recent history, we learn a lot more about the Office of Treaty Settlements, which is within the Ministry of Justice. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And you have some personal experience there as well, right?
Yes, so I worked at the Office of Treaty Settlements, and I also worked at another part of the Ministry of Justice called the Waitangi Tribunal. And these two agencies are connected in the sense that the Waitangi Tribunal was set up originally in 1975 to hear claims from Māori based on the Treaty of Waitangi. So claims that in fact, the principles of the treaty had been breached. And the Waitangi Tribunal is a quasi-judicial body. So it's a commission of inquiry. It's intended to be independent. It has its membership is roughly 50% Māori, 50% non-Māori. It has a mix of judges, lawyers, historians, people who are skilled in Māori language, culture and practices as well, all make up the membership of that tribunal. And so the tribunal hears claims and reports to government on those claims, and it can make recommendations about what needs to happen, either to provide some compensation or some recompense for breaches that have occurred, or it can make recommendations to government in order to prevent further prejudice occurring because of breaches of the treaty. Now, the Waitangi Tribunal just only makes recommendations, and they're non-binding. So the government can decide whether to adopt those recommendations or not. Now, what happened in the mid-1990s was that this other body, the Office of Treaty Settlements, gets set up in order to negotiate the directly negotiate settlements with particular Māori communities. So Māori community might have a whole lot of historical claims which might relate to land alienation or land confiscation or natural resources or a whole lot of other issues. And the Office of Treaty Settlements will come in and engage in negotiation with them to come up with a settlement package. And so that's the process that in the case of these historical claims that has really been, well, is really now being led by the Office of Treaty Settlements.
Mm-hmm. Last question, Karen, before I let you go. You say at the end of the book that many more stories of Maori legal traditions remain to be told. What needs to happen for those stories to be able to be told?
Well, I think one of the key things is that we do recognise that what we're talking about is law and a legal system, and that it is based on all the kinds of things that we expect from a kind of sophisticated legal system. And that means that it's not frozen in time, that it's dynamic and that it adjusts to meet the needs of the community. And so I think that's a really important part of that. It's also an important part of engaging with the state legal system, so that the state legal system understands that what is happening here is that we're engaging two different legal systems. It's not one legal system trying to adapt a particular cultural practice, but rather a cultural practice that is embedded in a whole social system, including a legal system as well. And so I think that's really important. And you know, there's work I think that Māori communities can be doing to reinvigorate those, to ensure that those stories are being told, and to ensure that we're using them in a way that regulates our own conduct, and that we are using them as law as well.
Karwin, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's legal scholar Karwin Jones. His new book is New Treaty, New Tradition, Reconciling New Zealand and Maori Law, published in 2016 by the University of British Columbia Press. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.